Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have Ed Hussein with us today to discuss his recent report on creating a global fund to counter violent extremism. Ed Hussein is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at CFR, where he focuses on trends within Arab Islamism, perceptions of the West and the Arab world, and U.S. policy toward the Middle East. Mr. Hussein is a critic of extremism and is the author of The Islamist, which was a finalist for the George Orwell Prize for Political Writing. His forthcoming book, The Sufis, will be published later this year. And thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could begin by talking about your idea of how a global fund can counter violent extremism and offer the practical applications for how to support moderate voices to disprove the narrative of extremists.
Irina, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you to your team for making this happen. And thank you to all of you who are on the call today. I won't take too much time. I'll be brief so we can have a much more thorough discussion than Q&A. The thinking behind the Global Fund comes from, I mean, two fronts, really. One, my experience in setting up Quilliam in the United Kingdom back in 2007. And when I left Quilliam in 2010 and came to CFR, one of the things that stayed in my mind was the constant need for the good people at Quilliam to focus sometimes 50%, sometimes 40% of their work, rather than on countering extremist voices and narratives within Muslim communities and within the far-right communities in Europe and the Greater Middle East. By Greater Middle East, I'm including Pakistan here. They spent a lot of their time, we spent a lot of our time fundraising. And that difficulty of being distracted from the urgent and imminent dangers of Al-Qaeda supporters being on the doorsteps of some mosques, I hasten to add, not all mosques and not most mosques, but some mosques, and that exposure to the narrative came in the form of leaflet distributions, came in the form of radical imams, came in the form of extremist websites or commentary on, say, Al Jazeera Arabic or Al Jazeera English's website. It came in the form of university prayer rooms and university events being dominated by people who had sympathy with Al-Qaeda's version of Islam. Rather than focus on all of that, and Quilliam and others were well suited to do that, what we often found was we were busy in the business of fundraising. And that experience wasn't just limited to Muslims in Europe. I found that to be the difficulty for mainstream moderate Muslims in Pakistan, in Egypt, and to some extent here in the US, but most certainly in countries further east from Europe. So the challenge was then, what do we do about it? And that was the first strand of my concern about the funding element. The second strand was last year there was a summit between Google Ideas and us here at the Council on Foreign Relations in Dublin on the importance of countering the message of violent extremism. And there, one of the things that Jim Lindsay, the Director of Studies and Vice President here at the Council, and I was on the panel concluding that Google Summit, that we promised that we would take this idea of creating a global fund to people who could make it happen. And CFR has great ideas and it has great access points. We take ideas to policymakers and powerful people who could make things happen. And Richard Haass, to his credit, at that time said that I should write a policy innovation memo. And that's where the idea for the memo came from, in other words, calling for the pooling of resources from both the public sector and, more importantly, perhaps the private sector in Turkey, in Gulf countries, in Indonesia, and wherever else there's commitment to putting money behind voices on the ground, led by what's now known as the Global Counterterrorism Forum, which is a 29 member organization, including the European Union, the United States, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and a whole host of other countries. So, the memo was written, it was taken by me to friends in government to try and bring it to the attention of people who could operationalize it. And to cut a long story short, we found a lot of interest in government because they too realize this problem I highlighted of people being committed to reclaiming their faith from Al-Qaeda's dominating of it in the public domain at least. But yet they constantly found this challenge of long-term sustainable funding. And we're not talking about huge amounts of money. I extrapolated the number of, say, $200 million over 10 years. And I think in the larger scheme of things, it's not a huge amount of money, but that's a good starting point. And, you know, that sort of money goes very far in countries such as Somalia, Mali, Kenya, Pakistan, Egypt, Indonesia, and elsewhere. So, practical applications then, the fund was declared, or the launch of it was declared earlier this month by Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Davutoglu of Turkey. And there were, I think, the full membership of the Global Counterterrorism Forum here at the margins of the United Nations. And I've since written an op-ed piece arguing for the kind of work it should fund, but I'll just highlight the sort of work it should fund. When it becomes operational early next year, and then perhaps we can hand back to Irina. I mean, to my mind, there's no shortage of Muslim thought leaders in mosques and university campuses that want to reclaim their faith from violent extremists, and not just violent extremists, but extremists too. You know, this is a real challenge in Egypt, challenge in Saudi Arabia, it's a challenge in other countries. But often they don't know the arguments and the emotional appeal of those who are inside those radical organizations. The silver lining in the crowd since 9/11 is there are now lots of young people in most of these countries who were previously involved with extremist organizations are now more than willing to share the intellectual, emotional, and faith-based appeal of extremism. And yet those individuals, many of them in Europe, many of them in Pakistan, hundreds of them in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, have not been utilized through a centralized body. And one of the things the fund could do is facilitate greater communication, openness, candor between former radicals and imams and other thought leaders who can then understand what it is that drew young, pious, intelligent Muslims into the embrace of Al-Qaeda. A second area where I think the Global Fund ought to concentrate is, given that in Arab countries we have a problem of unemployment, in some countries at 30%, some countries at 20%, and given that in a country such as Egypt, 40% of the population is under the age of 25, and given that we don't have a culture of reading books in the same way that we may have in other countries, what we have, therefore, by default, is a lot of focus on television watching in most Arab countries. And therefore, the popularity of satellite TV channels is huge. And we saw some of that impact play out in the recent coup d'etat against President Morsi. People bought into the narrative that was conveyed on state media and through satellite TV channels. Conversely, Islamist extremists in many of those countries have satellite TV channels, but there are very few voices, with the likely exception of the Amr Khalid in Egypt, that have satellite TV channels to counter those voices. So I've written about this, and one of the things that I hope that the Global Fund would consider is putting money behind satellite television channels that can undermine the message of separatism, confrontation, radicalism that often comes in European countries too, and not just in the Arab world, from those who are less, shall we say, conventional Muslims. So that would be the second aspect, funding long-term sustainable basis for satellite TV channels. A third area is, to the credit of people like Tahir al-Qadri in Pakistan, or even to some extent Salman al-Auda in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, and there are others in other countries, they've written about undermining the scriptural and theological narratives that Al-Qaeda uses, ideas such as al-Walla wal-Bara, Takfir, Hakimiyya, and so on. They've been written against, but their writings have not been disseminated either through translation and publication from Urdu into Swahili from an Arabic into Urdu and so on. So there's a lot of interchange that needs to happen, hasn't happened. So a third area of funding could be to take something like Tahrir al-Qadr's fatwa against radicalism and terrorism and the Al-Qaeda narrative and disseminate it into Arabic and convert it from Ali Jumu'ah into Urdu. So that would be a third. A fourth would be one of the things that we've seen happen a lot is Al-Qaeda's narrative isn't just limited to its own website, such as Al-Sahab, but often jihadis use Al Jazeera Arabic and other mainstream Arabic websites and come onto the comment sections of op-ed pieces or news pieces and leave their comments behind, often left uncontested. There ought to be a unit set up in various countries, whether led by government or independent of government, that dedicates itself to around-the-clock presence online to contest, puncture, and undermine Al-Qaeda's narrative online, given the rates of unemployment and the appeal of the internet for many young Muslims in several countries that are of importance on this agenda. And my final point is something I think more doable here in the United States, and that is the perception often put out by Al-Qaeda and its various supporters that the United States government is at war with Islam and Muslims and that it has disrespect for Islam. And most Muslims, for a host of reasons, and I think rightly so, think that their religion ought to be respected by the West and at its helm, the United States. And debates here about the Grand Zero Mosque and whatnot help only advance that view that somehow the U.S. is at war with Islam and Muslims. It's not. It's just a fact that the United States government does not have animosity towards Islam and Muslims. But that often gets ignored because of the color that comes out of the media here, some of the U.S. Congress personnel recently visiting particular countries in the Middle East and making noises that gives extreme Islamists ammunition to say the U.S. is at war. I think one of the things the U.S. government can do, especially when something such as the President's annual State of the Union address occurs, to have prominent ulama or religious leaders from some of those countries that are mainstream, that are moderate, in attendance as guests of the U.S. President or guests of the U.S. Congress. And that then, I think, helps multiply or put out a message through Arab media outlets and through the followers of many of these clerics. And by followers, I'm not talking about tens of people, but millions of people who follow them would then be seen that in one of the most prestigious political arenas of the world, i.e. the U.S. Congress, that religious leaders were respected as guests of the U.S. President or guests of the U.S. Congress. So those would be the sort of ideas I think that we could put out there and fund. I think I'll hand back to Irina here, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Ed. Let's turn it over to the group for questions and comments.
At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please dial star 2. Again, to ask a question, dial star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our first question will come from Mohammed Elanasu of Islamic Society of North America. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Irina, and thank you so much, Ed, for your brilliant work. I really appreciate the ideas. Very critical for us as a community. I just want to really talk about your final points, and I think that is the big question of credibility here is very critical for us. And your final point, you know, when you said that it's critical also to work with imams and basically empowering credible religious leaders in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, to take leadership in this countering violence extremism. I think it's very critical because a lot of these extremist elements that we see, to your final point, people see the United States, they see United States through drones, they see United States through the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places. So that's why when you see this global forum for counterterrorism is led by countries, then the credibility is lost somewhere. That's why it is very critical to empower people in the region to take leadership on this. And this is something that needs to be discussed. Thank you so much.
Ed, do you want to comment? Yes.
Sure. Firstly, thanks to Dr. Mohammed Sanusi's point, and also want to echo the excellent work that you and the Islamic Society for North America, ISNA, do. And I think it goes without saying that the fabulous work that ISNA has done stands as an example for many Muslims in Europe and elsewhere to see that Americans here, American Muslims, are both at home as being both Westerners and Muslims in a way that helps, again, puncture that narrative that somehow the West and Islam are at odds, that Muslims can't be Westerners and Americans. ISNA and the work Dr. Mohammed Sanusi has done over the decades and his colleagues there have helped, again, puncture that narrative. And, I mean, I don't mean to exaggerate the point, but the best ambassadors that the United States of America has to the constituencies that Dr. Sanusi is highlighting happens to be American Muslims. American Muslims have gone out of the way again and again to make the point that suicide bombers aren't going to heaven anywhere, they're going to hell, and they're not martyrs, they're murderers. That was highlighted by American Muslim scholars such as Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen and others after 9/11. And it was tense at that point to do that because suicide bombings were seen to be something that was worthy of support given Middle East politics. But ISNA and their partners such as Sheikh Hamza Yusuf and others have helped pioneer that debate within Islam globally, and that came from American Muslim leadership, so credit to them for doing so. I would respond to your point about credibility by saying you're absolutely right, and that's one of the reasons why this forum has several Muslim governments. But that said, I also am acutely aware that Muslim governments are often seen to be part of the problem by the very radicals that we're trying to reach out to. And therefore, bringing on private partners, people who have both organizational as well as wealthy links to donate money, to open up resources, to give us access to their networks in the Emirates, in Kuwait, in Riyadh, in Indonesia, is something that the fund seeks to do, both bring on board private individuals and thereby access private networks of credible ulama and support existing credible work rather than try to create that is seen to be government-fostered. So, I mean, I don't speak on behalf of the Global Fund, but I think I'm right in trying to convey what I pick up among those who are driving the fund, that they're sensitive to this, and your concerns are valid.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Randy Tift of World Vision. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. So, flowing actually from your last answer, my question is, would this effort in any way look at current U.S. foreign assistance programs and how they have been designed and implemented with the questions of security and countering violent extremism in mind? And I'm thinking particularly of the tough spot that relief and development organizations like World Vision are in, quite often working in the same country or context as U.S. government-funded programs that may have kind of blended security and development or humanitarian objectives. And I'm thinking, for example, the Trans-Sahel Counterterrorism Partnership that's been going for some 8 or 9 years may not be very visible to people who aren't working full-time on relief and development, but it's actually been a regional West Africa program where, you know, the objectives have actually been to counter the emergence or recruitment of terrorists, but the actual programs are more livelihoods, education, and traditional, you know, transition recovery or development type programs. What we've found is that it really is sort of unnecessary to blend these objectives, and it actually makes it harder for implementing partners or policy partners of the U.S. government who may be working, say, on USAID grants, to actually work under those programs, or even sometimes to share the space, becomes harder because the connection to the U.S. government is so overt and to the security objectives of the U.S. government are made so plain and overt. It actually requires discretion. And some of this, as it may relate to countering the recruitment of, say, terrorists in the same country where you have both humanitarian and development objectives, it may actually be best done in a quiet and very discreet way. So how do you address that, and how could private partners, how would you see private partners like those of us working in this field engaging given those risks?
Excellent question. And my two initial thoughts are that first, you're absolutely right that many of the work, or much of the work that's done to counter violent extremism can be done without that label, because the label tends to be contentious, label tends to isolate people. And I think the Global Fund's been now called the Global Fund for Resilience and Community Engagement. So intentionally they took out the title Countering Violent Extremism for the very tensions that you rightly highlight. So it's already been named as the Global Fund for Community Engagement and Resilience, or the other way around. I mean, I forget the precise name, but the point being that the name is such that it tries to mitigate that concern. My second point is that one of the, I think, strategic advantages of this fund is that while it creates difficulty with the first question that Dr. Sanusi asked, in other words, having government endorsement, in this case local government endorsement, in other words, because foreign ministries of many of these countries are already involved, it therefore makes it easy for private partners and the kind of organizations that you highlighted to work in those countries, because they're approved by the foreign ministry, and we assume thereby, therefore, that other arms of government, interior ministries or courts and others, will not necessarily oppose the work done by foreign NGOs in those countries because it's approved by the foreign ministry that's part of the Global Counterterrorism Forum that understands this work and therefore helps. But that said, it does have this risk where extremist organizations would think, well, this is government approved and therefore we have a credibility problem with it. So it's a fine line to tread, and I think it will vary from country to country. In some countries it won't be that much of a challenge. I'm thinking about Turkey, but that said, Turkey doesn't have a huge radicalism problem unless its current support for extremist Syria comes home and backfires. But in other countries it will be a problem. So it varies from country to country, and I think the best mitigator against it is to have, depending on the country that the fund is targeting and the organizations, both public and private, are working, to have credible voices in those countries work with the sector that you identify, the foreign assistance programs, or the more blunt counter-extremism voices. So, for example, I would say if the work was being done in a country such as Mauritania, or if the work was being done in a country such as Yemen, two different parts of the target countries that come to my mind, at least. In Mauritania, it's hard for even the most extreme Al-Qaeda supporters or those countries neighboring Mauritania to discredit someone like Sheikh Abdullah bin Beya. He was, yes, a government minister, but his religious credentials and his religious lineage is such that regardless of who he's working with, because of his personality and his gravitas, he will be taken seriously and not to be discredited by almost every side of the debate. His scholarship is such. Similarly, in Yemen, if we were to identify some of the what are called the Habaib, Habib Ali al-Jifri or Habib Omar, these are men who have a century of scholarship and lineage that goes behind them, and association with the local foreign ministry or with external internal partners doesn't discredit them. So the point I'm trying to make is finding credible voices like that and their equivalents in other countries. And I just highlight those, but I'm sure that I've not mentioned tens of others in other countries. Those are the kind of voices that I think ought to be brought in as partners for both the kind of work you highlight and the kind of work that needs to happen on the more hard end of countering Al-Qaeda narrative that doesn't necessarily bring questions of credibility to the work the fund is aiming to support.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Next question or comment will come from Thomas Youssef of Friends of UN Alliance. But before that, if you do have a question, please dial *1 on your touchtone phone now. Please go ahead.
Hi, Ed. Thank you very much for that. I saw your op-ed, and I was looking forward to this discussion. I had a couple of I was at the UN Alliance of Civilizations where I was running a education about religions and beliefs project, and one of the things we were trying to do was to actually collect evidence of the impact of education about religions on countering extremism. And a few of the studies I saw, which dealt with Indonesia, Afghanistan and the United States, but not in relation to extremism, but rather to religious tolerance, did provide some kind of positive evidence in that regard. So a lot of the activities that are being talked about for this seems to me to be, on the one hand, doing the right thing by looking at informal efforts such as through the media and the internet. But there doesn't seem to be much emphasis at the K-12 level, because from what I read from these studies and this sheikh you mentioned from Mauritania, if a person is well educated about their religion, when an extremist approaches them, they are able to counter and say, no, what you're saying is not what the Quran says, because the Quran says this, and this is why the Quran says this, and, you know, to provide a kind of backing, because I think the problem is that a lot of the people who are approached have either very little knowledge or are only get one side of the view. So my question is this fund going to do something about education at the K-12 level and about research into practices, particularly in the informal education sector or the private education sector in Muslim countries where teaching about religions, different religions, is practiced and the impact thereof?
Thank you. I should say that the ideas that I highlighted at the beginning of this conversation and I mentioned in my op-ed piece are mine and mine alone, and it might be that the fund adopts some of those. I hope it does and supports them. But it's also worth saying that the fund will identify its own opportunities, and much of what you say may well be in line with the kind of work the fund wants to support. I would say, though, that the sentiments you express are absolutely correct. Mark Sageman did research on this very phenomenon, although he looked at those who became suicide bombers, and not just extremists, but violent extremists, and why they went down that pathway and how many of them had a religious education in their youth and their pre-youth years, and those who became suicide bombers, many of them had no religious background or religious training in their early years. So what you say is borne out by the research and the study already out there. My comeback, if I may call it that, is to say that the impact of religious education is important, yes, and you're absolutely right that those who have a religious education tend to be much more immune to extremism. But much of it depends on what kind of religious education. I think in a country such as Pakistan, most of the time, up to now, the religious education has not been one that's extreme, has not been one that endorses a world view of Islam being at war or living in a Darul Harb or abode of warfare mindset. But without naming countries, there are countries in which that tends to be the default mode of instruction from a very young age. And there, I think, reform of education and curriculum is important, but I'm not sure if that's the work of the fund. But I hear what you're saying, and I think I'm in broad agreement with you, and you're absolutely right. Those who have a religious education from a very young age tend to be much more immune to extremism, which is another argument to prove why Islam is an answer to extremism and why Islam is not part of the problem, which is what some tend to analyze and therefore prescribe.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Azza Karam of UN Population Fund. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the presentation. Forgive me if the question is redundant, if you may have answered it, because I did come in pretty late, for which I'm sorry. But I was just curious to see your take on the notion of extremism, especially given the, if you will, the recent reinterpretation of it that we see in contexts such as Egypt, where previous groups who were, in this case, like the Muslim Brotherhood, who were indeed elected into power, were the discourse around them shifted to label them, in some cases, or some of their activities as terrorists. Where would some of what you say stand vis-a-vis some of those kinds of dynamics? Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that question. I've had the good fortune of meeting with the Muslim Brotherhood on multiple occasions over the last 3 years, and there are many things, and yes, they have problems, and yes, they have a long way to go in terms of embracing the modern world for what it is, but they're not terrorists. And I say that on the basis of my own affiliation with them many years ago as a student, and I say that on the basis of having interviewed their current leadership, and I say that on the basis of those who are in fact terrorists in Egypt now, those who are, say, affiliated with Ayman al-Zawahiri's brother, Mohammed al-Zawahiri. I'm not saying he's a terrorist, but he certainly supports al-Qaeda, he supports his brother's message, and he supports the outcome of those narratives. The Muslim Brotherhood have gone out of his way to stop not just Ayman al-Zawahiri's brother's message from being amplified, but even those Salafis who tended to want to become more violent after the revolution and most recently after the military's actions. People such as Khairat al-Shatir inside the Brotherhood have gone out of the way to stop that violence. I realize that there were political protests and street protests and killings and counter-killings, but that's more in the realm of the domestic political crisis rather than in the vein of al-Qaeda terrorism, and I think it's a mistake for us to see the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt as being part of al-Qaeda or being part of a terror problem. And the Brotherhood has walked this pathway before in the 1960s when Gamal Abdel Nasser made similar allegations against the Brotherhood. In those days, those allegations stood. The Brotherhood, or at least some of its members, assassinated the Egyptian Prime Minister, were involved in bombing of cinemas and nightclubs and bars. But the Brotherhood did a turnaround and it abandoned violence in the 1970s. And to this day, despite many hardships and despite at times opting for violence may, to their view, being strategically advantageous, they've taken a principled view and a principled stance, and they haven't. And I think it's one of the injustices of our time in the Middle East that a democratically elected government was overthrown. Whatever the details, I think it's wrong to term them as terrorists, and they remain a force that wants to re-enter the political process at some point as citizens.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please dial star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question will come from Azeem Farooqi of Islamic Center of Rockland, New York. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum, Mr. Hussain. I am from the Islamic Center of Rockland, New York, and I'm delighted to hear from you and be involved in listening and what you are talking about. I am personally at the Islamic Center of Rockland, we are quite involved in the interfaith activities. You mentioned earlier about the suicide bomber. I was speaking at the Rockland Community College, and I was asked the same question by a student, if the suicide bomber go to heaven and meet 72 virgins? And obviously I answered, no, they go to hell and meet 72 devils. So anyway, what I wanted to mention to you was that American Library Association of the United States, along with National Endowment of Arts, have initiated a project, Muslim Journeys, and they have provided 25 books and a couple of documentaries to almost all the libraries in the United States. And so my question is, or suggestion is, will your fund that you are talking about would have something similar to reach as a grassroots education? I mean, it's nice to have, you mentioned Muslim guests to be invited to the State of Union address. But what I'm suggesting is would have potentially more impact if your fund could do something similar to what the ALA and NEA have already done, and the project is in process now.
Thank you for that suggestion. This whole conversation is being recorded. I will most certainly pass that suggestion on to those who will be managing the fund.
Thank you for the comment. Next question or comment?
Our next question will come from Don Smedley of Riverdale Institute.
Yes, thank you for your talk so far. I just have one question. Is any of the work that you're considering going to be made available to the refugees from Syria that are particularly in Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey? It seems like that could be a particularly good location, but I realize it's new in terms of opportunity. Thank you.
One of the co-chairs of the initiative that's behind the fund is Turkey, and Jordan is also a member of the Global Counterterrorism Forum. Both Jordan and Turkey combined host most of the refugees. I think Lebanon and Iraq are close second and third, with Egypt as a fourth. But the suggestion you make is reachable, but again, I'm not in a position to make commitments other than to say that I will pass on your thoughts to those who are able to operationalize your ideas and your concerns.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Mohammed El-Sanusi of Islamic Society of North America. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ed. Again, I really don't have a question, but I just want to really emphasize the point that Ed mentioned of bringing to the forefront moderate voices, and he particularly mentioned Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayyah. I think it's very critical, very credible voice in the Muslim world. You know, recently probably it and others probably have seen, he actually resigned from his position as the vice president of the Union of International Scholars. And his argument was, he said that his moderate voice and rhetoric for peace and reconciliation that he is, you know, taking is actually is not, you know, in kind of agreement with the rhetoric that the Union is doing, particularly after the Arab Spring and all of that. So I think people like that, bringing them in the forefront, in the table, when planning for empowering grassroots and civil society groups and religious leaders in the Muslim world to take leadership in providing that alternative narrative, I think is very critical. So I just want to add that comment.
Thank you. Ed, shall we continue on, or do you want to respond?
No, I want to underscore everything Dr. Mohammed El-Sanusi says, and I think it's worth just saying that Dr. Sanusi represents the largest Muslim body here in America, the Islamic Society of North America. Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayyah is a mainstream Sunni scholar who's currently based in Saudi Arabia, originally from Mauritania, but has appeal around the world. So for the benefit of those who are perhaps not familiar with the personalities in the global Muslim scene, we're talking about numbers that range in the millions, and we're talking about someone who has global influence. But I would also go a little further, and I would say that another voice that's perhaps more known to people on this call is someone such as Sheikh Rashid Ghannouchi in Tunisia. I'm not sure where some of the American Muslim community is on the importance of Sheikh Ghannouchi in reconciling democracy and Islam and even secularism. I mean, he's distinguished between different types of secularism. He spoke here at the council on the record, so I'm not divulging anything that's not been put out in the public domain. One of the areas of contention with extremists is often their reluctance to accept a secular pluralist state. And both Sheikh bin Bayyah, but also more particularly Sheikh Ghannouchi from Tunisia, the leader of the Ennahda party, has gone out of his way to find ways in which not French-style laicity or more extreme forms of secularism, but the more American-stroke-British modes of coexistence of religion and politics in the public domain. I think Sheikh Ghannouchi is someone who, again, ought to be brought to the forefront and given a more regional platform, because one of the reasons why the rise of extremism became such a problem in Egypt, and I don't think it's going to go away just because there's been a shutting down of it temporarily in the public space by putting people in bars, or behind bars rather, is there was a lack of intellectual clarity on the meaning of Islam and politics or exegete. I think we have the makings of a Muslim response and a Muslim way of accommodating the modern world by sidelining Al-Qaeda, not just in political but scriptural terms, but I don't want to go too far down that road, but just to put the thought out there for those of you who are thinking about it, that those voices are out there and they do lead millions of people, but, mm-hmm. but they need to be further amplified.
Yeah, Ed, I think you are absolutely correct, and we're at the Islamic Society of North America working with both of them, with Sheikh Bin Bayya and Sheikh Qannouchi on our project on religious freedom and rights of religious minorities in the Muslim world. So we hosted several events hosted by Sheikh Qannouchi in Tunisia and Sheikh Abdullah Bin Bayya in Mauritania. And in fact, this Saturday we're heading to Senegal because the president also of Senegal, Macky Sall, is hosting for us a conference on religious freedom and rights of minorities in the Muslim world, where Sheikh Bin Bayya actually the head of the scholars committee on this project. So these kind of credible voices are very critical to bring a different narrative and basically very authentic in the Muslim world.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from James Harper of First Presbyterian Church. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I want to applaud the use of satellite, first of all. Got contacts in Iran and Egypt that they're using satellite and having great success with them. I think it's a very effective way to get a message out. I'm really curious about the narrative. You know, we've spoken about replacing the narrative, and I think I got a pretty good idea of the prevailing narrative that exists, and we've talked about refuting different pieces of that. But to really change the narrative, you have to have an alternative that's a significant substance that's is equally attractive to the previous narrative. So I just wonder if you would mind take some time to flesh out more of the substance of what an alternative narrative would look like that would be compelling and could gain traction as an alternative narrative for the community.
Sure. Thank you for that question. I think I just want to introduce my response to this by saying something that was said to me by a student of one of the sheikhs that we just mentioned, and he said he's been working on the alternative narratives now for about 7 years, and one of the most powerful points I thought he made was that he's and others who work on this, this is not an alternative narrative, but theirs is the narrative, and there's truth to that. And I think too often what happens for those of us looking at it, I think from a more distant point of view, is we think that they're trying to develop an alternative. The extremist narrative is in fact the alternative narrative. The mainstream narrative rejects, and I'll come into the details in a moment, the literalism that infects extremism, that the mainstream moderate normative view among Muslims for the last 1400 years has been you never take a verse of the Quran or the Hadith of the Prophet in isolation. It's a well-established principle that everything is taken within, number one, historical context, number two, the reason why it was revealed, number two, how you apply it in the modern world. And various scholars have various explanations, but the minority view, the Al-Qaeda and its affiliates' view, is to take verses in isolation. So where it says kill them wherever you find them, for example, they will say, oh, this applies today to when it comes to Israeli citizens or when it comes to governments with whom we disagree and their supporters, you know, because in the Quran it says kill them wherever you find them. But that verse was revealed up to the Prophet after 14 years of persecution. There's a specific context for that, and other scholars do not necessarily think, most scholars do not think that would apply to ordinary people in most parts of the world. So that's one example, I think, of the literalism of the minority view. The mainstream view, the mainstream normative narrative, is very much that all of this literalism is a deviation from the norm. A second would be that, you know, jihad is a Muslim obligation until God's law is manifest. And this is the Hakimiyya belief, again, very much on the minority view. The majority of the world's Muslims have, for the last 1400 years, believed that the various manifestations of jihad do not necessarily mean that a literalist version of what they consider to be God's government is imposed. Many of the most prominent Muslim scholars, including Ibn Taymiyyah's students, always rejected that any government could claim to be God's government. And one of the things that we saw play out in the very first century of Islam was the Prophet's own grandchildren, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, were killed by a manifestation of this extremism, of trying to do away with this notion of God's government. I mean, I can carry on, but what I would refer to, without sounding like too much of a theologian or a historian on any of this, is the policy memo I wrote. In it, I refer to some of these extreme ideas, a combination of literalist religion and conspiracy theory-based politics that leads to the birth of this narrative. And I would say that this narrative, this alternative narrative, this extreme narrative out there is relatively modern. There's been some birth of it in the early years of Islam. It was killed off. It came about again in the 13th century. It was killed off. And it came about again in the 18th century, and now we're struggling with it again. So for the 1400 years of Muslim tradition, this has been an abomination, a deviation, a narrative that's on the minority fringes. And the majority has always been the narrative. I'd refer you to the memo, if I may, and if you've got more specific questions, I'm happy to respond to you via email.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question will come from Mark Johnson of Stony Point Center. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Hussein. Yvonne Tseng, in her delightful book, Men in Black Dresses, more than a decade ago, spoke about how effectively already El-Azhar and other universities were using the Internet in service to a moderate Islam. I'm wondering if there has been slippage in that, because it seems to me to be the most effective path to have this message coming from within Islam. I'd rather see $200 or $300 million invested in further correcting the American perspective on Islam in terms of what we might do from here. But I'm curious as to, has there been slippage in the capacity of clerics in the Middle East, or are you still looking only to enhance a skill set that's already there?
The skill set is there, without doubt. And you correctly identify Al-Azhar, but Al-Azhar and other institutions have somewhat been compromised because of the political realities and the financial difficulties that they find themselves in those countries. I mean, Al-Azhar had a waqf, which was an endowment. That whole culture of endowments was in the Muslim world for 1,350 years. You had the rise of socialism through Gamal Abdel Nasser that stripped institutions such as Al-Azhar of their waqf, their endowments, and putting it under state control, and thereby not just financially compromising them, but politically undermining their message, because what we saw from that point onwards was repeatedly several Al-Azhar dons making the mistake of being too close to the Egyptian government. So there's been that, and as a result of that, there's been some slippage in the effectiveness of their message. But they're not as effective as they could be, and I think greater advice and finances being made available to them would render them more effective. I agree with your sentiment that more resources ought to be directed towards educating American thought leaders on the viability of coexistence between Islam and the West, and much of that ought to be focused on. This is not the point of this call, so I don't want to get too misdirected into that domain. But there is, I think, growing. I mean, I don't like the word Islamophobia, but there is a misunderstanding of Islam and Muslims, and some of that stems from the actions of some Muslims. But a greater degree of education here would help then rebalance the other extreme when Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, Islam and Muslims, are under persecution in America. Some of those court cases, some of those banning of mosques, some of those Quran burning attempts, some of those claims of creeping Sharia clarify or add evidence to a misguided narrative.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question will come from Emino Gamawa of Harvard Law School. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, brother, for this very important talk. We are discussing an issue that has a transnational character, and because of technology and globalization, this extremist group now expanding to sub-Saharan Africa, recruiting in places like East and West Africa, and we are seeing what is happening in northern Nigeria, Mali, and Somalia. Are you doing anything particularly that is targeted towards these vulnerable groups in sub-Saharan Africa? And if you are, what are some of the barriers and challenges of working across cultures that you have seen over the years? And how do you reconcile between promoting freedom of religion and pushing a particular narrative of Islam, which does not necessarily actually, in some cases, find traction with some groups? So I really want to know what are the tensions in the process of this work, and specifically what you are doing in sub-Saharan Africa, an area that I have worked on, especially on northern Nigeria, and I will be glad to know how together we can work and see how we can better educate our population, and if we can share resources, what are the type of resources that can be shared, and if there are challenges, how do we overcome these challenges?
Thank you for the question. I'm reluctant to comment on the areas that you mentioned. My focus is particularly on the Middle East and at a stretch, Pakistan. I would also say that we're not in the business of really promoting any one brand of Islam. It's some of the scholars that I highlighted earlier are as mainstream and as normative as they come, and I think they're exceptionally credible, and those who will manage the fund will identify some of the areas that you mentioned. And again, I'm not in a position to comment on operations. I'm trying to highlight the importance of the fund and the importance of the narrative that it's trying to undermine, how and why. And again, if you want to drop me an email, I'm happy to put you in touch with people who will be operationalizing the fund, and perhaps you and they can have a conversation once the fund is up and running, which is the middle of next year. That's why it's been announced that the U.S. government and Turkey and their private sector partners are in the business of fundraising to get the global fund operationalized by the middle of next year. Perhaps one more question, Irina?
Yes, I think we have time for one more question.
Thank you. Our one more question will come from Aza Karam of UN Population Fund. Please go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity once again, and again, thanks for the excellent presentations and answers. I just wanted to come back again, and it's not to be bothersome, but just to reiterate the question perhaps a little bit more clearly. I'm very familiar with the dynamics of political Islam across the Muslim-majority countries. What I'm more interested and fascinated by, and that I feel we haven't necessarily underlined enough, is what happens in the context when groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, as you mentioned earlier, a lot herself has been compromised by the dynamics of its co-optation by some of the state structures in Egypt. But I would argue similarly that the Muslim Brotherhood's experience and governance has, in a sense, also compromised it somewhat, compromised part of its credibility and legitimacy. Therefore, you have some significant numbers, for instance, in Egypt, of citizens who feel, rightly or wrongly is not the point, but who feel the Brotherhood discourse verges on that of quote-unquote terrorism. I totally get your point that that should not be the case, but the fact of the matter is it is the case. Given those dynamics and those realities, the question remains how best do we counter that, and is it really sufficient then to think of the distinguished elders, if you will, such as Bin Bey and Ghanoushi, and fronting them and somehow having them being the critical interlocutors, is it really sufficient, or do we need to perhaps look beyond to a younger generation or younger strata from within this leadership? And if so, can we spend some time and energy on that? Is basically the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Aza. I mean, thoughtful questions. I'll just make three quick points, if I may, given the shortage in time. And I mean, I realize from the outset I most likely will not completely satisfy the angle from which you're coming at this. But I will say that one way of highlighting the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is not a terrorist organization, whatever the rights and wrongs of people's perception are, is to let it operate in the public domain, let its Freedom and Justice Party contend free and fair elections as it once did, and let it be part of the political process by way of a parliamentary election, rather than what's happening at the moment, putting them behind bars and helping radicalize a second and the third generation of people who are watching their elders and those that were trained by them be put behind bars were essentially trying to be more democratic. I'm not saying they were successful. I hear many of the mistakes that you currently alluded to. The second point I would make is the young generation, I think, was led by people like Gihad al-Haddad and others who were inherently less radical and much more aligned towards the West and standing for pluralism. People like that are also behind bars. So it's difficult given the political realities inside Egypt, but I share your sentiment that a younger generation of leadership could perhaps guide the Islamist groups in another direction. But that can happen, I think, by them standing shoulder to shoulder with people like Ghannouchi. My final point would be those who are on the secular center-left of Egyptian politics may not necessarily agree with those on the center-right and Islamists and others, but we have to realize that there are people who are interesting bridges between those two ideational paradigms, and Ghannouchi, however politically involved he is in the detail of Tunisia, is an important thought leader that ought to be embraced and not sidelined.
Thank you for that, Ed. And I think we are unfortunately out of time, but I think this is a valuable conversation, and we look forward to seeing how this all unfolds and hearing more about it from you and others. If you want to send feedback or further questions, you can email us at outreach@cfr.org, and we can relay them to Ed. I would also just point you to Ed's work on the website at cfr.org, and also you can follow him on Twitter. So thank you again, Ed. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.